This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on February 24th, and today we're talking to John Udell. So, John, can you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Okay, well, let's see. I'll make it pretty quick. We'll pick up the story back when I was with Byte Magazine, where I was for quite a number of years, starting in the late 1980s. I came there from Lotus, where I was there for a year working on application software. Came to Byte, had a great time there, being an editor and a writer, and eventually was the guy that built out the Byte Magazine website back in dawn of the web era, and had a lot of fun writing a column about web development, building out Byte's website, and also exploring a lot of stuff around internet-based groupware, which became the subject of a book that I wrote for O'Reilly called Internet Groupware. Then Byte got torpedoed, and I was an independent developer and freelance writer for 4 or 5 years, and then I went to work for InfoWorld for a couple of years. And then I went to Microsoft in January of 2007, where I am currently employed remotely as a technical evangelist. And what I do is a mixture of kind of experimental programming and media stuff, podcasting and screencasting, and generally trying to, in many ways, do what I've always done, which is sort of have a broad portfolio of interests and learn about things, write about things, explain things, and connect the dots, or try to connect the dots between kind of technologies and various kinds of social issues and trends and things like that.
Your line on your blog says, I think, strategies for internet citizens. And I've seen a theme of kind of like sharing public data. How would you describe that?
That's a key part of it, and it's becoming a big phenomenon right now, and it's quite encouraging that the Obama administration is putting some muscle behind that. So I don't know if you've seen, but the requirements have now been posted for how the recovery funds are going to be tracked, and basically every agency that's receiving funds through this TARP program, well, not the TARP program, but through the bailout, basically. The agencies are all being required to report back using data feeds, which are in a format which I'm not actually sure what it is, but it's whatever feeds USAspending.gov. So it's some sort of structured data feed. And, you know, that's an example of the kind of thing that people have been jumping up and down for years about, and now it's starting to just happen. So that's a sort of a great first step, right? Because an awful lot of people have been in the game of running around screen scraping websites and trying to untangle PDF files and otherwise drag information out of the government, and now the government is beginning to acknowledge that it actually wants to provide that stuff in a more usable form. So long story short, there's starting to be a lot of public information that's coming available, and the people who are in a position to provide that information are beginning to get the message, because a bunch of people in the geek community have been telling them this for a while, that this stuff needs to be made available in forms that are structured and accessible through APIs and amenable to programmatic retrieval and manipulation. And so this is very encouraging, right? It's like I said, it's a good first step.
So is this information that is digestible by ordinary people, or is it information that you would kind of expect other people to sort of filter through and interpret and present in a more digestible form?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So it's information that is mainly not digestible by ordinary citizens. And one of my huge dreams here is that the kind of folks who are on this call can help to make it digestible and can put it into forms that enable
ordinary citizens to work with the stuff, make sense of it, and begin to reason with one another in the context of this information. Because ultimately, I mean, this is a pretty big deal, right? We face, as we know, some really formidable challenges right now, just as a society, even as a species, you could argue. And, you know, our problems have an awful lot to do with complex systems, and those complex systems are governed by complex information. And, you know, we're all in a situation of trying to make sense out of, you know, the environment, make sense out of the economy, make sense out of social policy. And, you know, the information that we all have at our disposal with which to make decisions is pretty poor. So, you know, all of us who believe in kind of data-driven reasoning, I think, are facing a real challenge, but also a huge opportunity to be able to make all kinds of processes saner and more data-driven. So it's, you know, I think it's a huge deal.
I've seen one of the ways that you're kind of trying to point the way with this is you've been doing an example application using Azure and Iron Python and Elm City. Is that related to this whole kind of thing at a micro scale?
Yeah, it is. It's very much related to it, and it's just it's kind of a piece of the puzzle. But this piece of the puzzle is important to me because I see it as a way in which I can show people what it means to participate in an ecosystem of data feeds, both as producers and consumers of those feeds. And so the domain is actually just calendars, which seems like an extremely mundane thing. It is a mundane thing, but it's also very much an unsolved problem. And if you go around and talk to people, you will find that there's just, even though it's the year 2009, and even though we've had the iCalendar standard operating on the web for 10 years now, if you can believe it, this is actually, November was the 10th anniversary of the iCalendar specification. So we've had this stuff seemingly forever. But yet, if you actually go around and look at how people produce and consume calendar information, it's a lot of HTML files, it's a lot of PDF files, it's kitchen calendars, it's almost anything but structured data feeds. And so what I'm trying to show here is that it's pretty straightforward using the tools that people already have, using very well-known and mature internet standards to build up, for example, in a community, what amounts to a federation of calendars, where what everyone who has information to offer does is just publishes a feed at some URL, where there is a registry which collects those feeds, and then various aggregations can be driven from that feed registry, and various different views can be produced of the stuff. And there doesn't have to be, and there really shouldn't be, any central point of control. You know, there's a pool of feeds, and there could be a population of services that consume those feeds for different audiences for different purposes, right? So you might have the view of all the schools. You might have the view of all the musical and arts stuff. You might have the complete view of everything that you can find. And it's led me into an appreciation of a lot of different aspects of what amounts to a huge disconnect, you know, between the geek world and what I call the civilian world. And one of them is just around the concept of structured information, because people in the real world, in the civilian world, very bright, very well-educated, very capable people, have absolutely no intuition about structured information. And so from their perspective, a computer file is a computer file. So you say, well, you know, if you were to publish this information in a structured form as a data feed on the web, then all of this syndication could happen, all of these network effects would flow out of it. And people say, well, I published this, you know, the high school calendar as a PDF file. There it is, you know, such and such .pdf. What's wrong with that? So there's just no, you know, there's no intuition that is, from our perspective, a radically different proposition than publishing something in XML or even, you know, iCalendar or anything that is structured and actually says, you know, what the location is and what the date is. And so that's, you know, that's one huge sort of, I think, conceptual obstacle here. And another one is the whole notion of feeds and loose coupling and syndication, which I think a lot of us now have really come to embrace and to take for granted. But it's very non-obvious to most people. And so after, you know, working with this for a while, going around and talking to people and showing them, you know, what this means, which is that, you know, you get to control your own information that you produce, right? You get to be the authoritative source for that. And then you provide it into the network, and everyone else who syndicates your stuff is getting the right stuff from you because you put it out there. And you're getting the right stuff from them because they put it out there, right? But this is all just woven together with this network of links and feeds. And people don't trust that process yet. They have, again, no intuition that this could possibly work, right? So what I run into again and again is that people are very strongly conditioned to want there to be a database or a repository or a single authority where the stuff lives. And so, you know, and this is, it doesn't just apply to calendar information. You can map this onto any scenario where people are trying to collectively manage information. And what you see is that invariably it winds up that people decide that there has to be a single authority, and everyone will basically bring their information to the single authority, and the single authority will then pull it together and publish it back out. And there's just no intuition, no sense that centralized process never works for this kind of thing. It'll never be complete. It'll never be flexible. It'll never be agile. Right? And then there's also no sense that, you know, the syndicated, federated thing can work either.
Well, so it seems like, you know, there's the kind of bottom-up approach where you can show something, you know, you can show to the local, you know, to your community, hey, we're able to share a calendar. This is cool, you know, and when you update the calendar, it automatically, you don't have to email a bunch of PDFs out, like everyone just knows, you know, like it shows up on their phone and their schedule and that kind of thing. And then there's the like very top-down approach where, like, you know, I saw recently that there's legislation, you know, governmental legislation from the SEC about using XBRL, the Extensible Business Reporting Language. And that's like a, if you're over $5 billion in capitalization or whatever, you are required to submit your data in this XML format. So there's kind of the very top down and the bottom up. And I guess, I mean, the two possibilities are that those just kind of meet in the middle, or I wonder if there's a way to, you know, work from the middle out as well, you know, to get, like, for instance, like if you're sharing data throughout your community, I mean, the next step is that your community would share with the region, you know, and through, like, you know, and expand out from that level. I wonder how that happens.
So first of all, back to your XBRL example, I think I would sort of separate out two things, right? So there's the issue of a canonical format, right? In this case, it's XBRL, XML Business Reporting Language. And then there's the issue of sort of topology, right? Now, in the case of the SEC, this is a scenario where companies are legally obliged to submit this information. And so, you know, there just is a structure there which has a hierarchical topology, and that just is the structure. You know, within that hierarchical structure, you know, there's an exchange format, in this case, XBRL, right? In the calendaring case, though, it's almost naturally a distributed topology. So to give you an example of this, right, one of the ways that people plug into this network of calendar feeds is through Eventful. So basically, the model right now is that I try to get everybody in the community who is or could be publishing event information that's relevant to the local community to surface up some kind of a calendar feed out of Outlook, out of Google Calendar. I don't care where it comes from, out of Drupal. There's, you know, lots of ways to publish ICS feeds. And then to make those endpoints known so that we can just collect them and we can sort of see the stuff that's going on, right? At the same time, you know, there are people who come through the community who aren't really sort of part of the community. And so imagine that you're a musician and you're on a tour and you're going to be in 25 different cities over the next 3 months, and my town is one of your cities. But what you would like to do is you would like to be able to publish a feed one time that is going to be picked up by, you know, the aggregator in my community for my audience and the aggregator in the other 24 communities for their audiences, right? And, you know, again, I mean, the whole sort of the traditional model of promotion and publicity says that, you know, you have to sort of suss out who is the person in each one of those communities that you have to send the press release to, right? And it's like a huge effort, and people with a lot of resources are able to pull that off. But if you're just a solo performer who's on tour, you know, you're not going to be able to do that, right? But in this model, those kinds of people are actually starting to show up, right? So the other day I saw this guy I'd never heard of, and he pops up and he's, you know, going to be doing a gig in my town in March. And that's indeed one of like 25 different gigs that he's doing in 25 cities. So why did he show up in my aggregator? Well, it's because he figured out that he could go to Eventful and he could post his event there. You know, so he did it once for each of his 25 cities in Eventful. So there's 25 events in Eventful, right? Well, my aggregator scans Eventful with a view of just the stuff that's local to me. So he's only going to touch my town like once a year, or maybe just once ever, right? But he still actually appeared on the calendar. And if the other 24 cities were running a similar process, then, you know, he could literally promote himself in 25 places by posting to that single source, right? So there's it's an incredibly decentralized kind of a model, and it's just a natural fit for a feed-driven, loosely coupled architecture.
Right. Any thoughts, guys? I think we're above our level of expertise here.
My brain hurts.
This is real. I mean, there's nothing fancy about this. That's the thing, right? This is the dilemma, is that it's all just, I mean, all these pieces are lying around, and you know all of these things, and there's nothing mysterious about it, right?
Right.
I mean, you know that you could go to eventful.com and, you know, you could, I mean, and you guys are programmers, right? You wouldn't even have to spend as much time as this guy did to enter this information, right? You would look at it and go, oh, that thing has an API, right? You would write a little program, and you would get your information into that system in a tenth of the time that he did.
Right.
He had to actually go through the interface. So you guys would even skip that part, right? So none of the pieces are hard, right? It's just that there's this architecture that's possible here, which is, which the only thing that's preventing it from happening is people getting the idea that these pieces can be used together in this combination for these purposes. It's just like purely conceptual.
Like a stack of Legos that just need to be put together. I mean, and there's the directions are right there as well. Like, I'm just thinking anything that we can think of as a kind of call to action, because I think in general our listeners are, you know, kind of intermediate to above average programmers. And so any things that we can think of to say, hey, do this, support this format, or, you know, that kind of thing would probably be.
Well, I would say the obvious call to action here is to anytime that you're, example, right? A guy in my town builds websites. He builds a bunch of websites for people around town. And these websites have calendars, and he's actually sort of standardized on Drupal. So he builds all these Drupal-based sites. And when I got going on this stuff, I looked around and I found that a bunch of them had calendars, and they were just surfacing the web page, the web representation of the calendar information. And I looked into it and I realized that, well, there actually is some other URL in there that you can tap into that'll get you the iCalendar, the ICS feed. And, you know, it turns out that this guy, you know, he didn't even know that was there, right? It was literally like to enable calendar feeds to come out of all these websites was just him flipping a switch in the configuration. And it just hadn't occurred to him because no one had ever asked him to do it. So, that'd be my obvious call to action, is anytime that, you know, you're doing something for a client or for your company or for anyone where there's calendar information, just make sure, just like it's reflexive, you know, for I think all of us right now, anytime there's anything that remotely could be produced as an RSS feed, we've kind of got the idea to produce the RSS feed just because you never know, you know, when it would be useful. This is the same kind of thing. I mean, I really regard the ICS format as RSS's kind of you know, poor stepchild, right? That never, you know, it actually can function in exactly analogous ways to RSS, but we've just, for whatever reason, never gotten around to thinking about it that way and using it that way.
So one of the things that this discussion brings to my mind is Yahoo Pipes, which, you know, I'm sure you've seen, you know, gives you the ability to sort of, in a graphical way, take in RSS feeds and structured data and sort of remix them and repackage them and publish them out again.
Yeah.
Which I've always thought it's been really cool, but I haven't really seen a whole lot of, you know, use outside of like, hey, this is kind of an interesting toy.
I can tell you my favorite application of Yahoo Pipes. It's a pattern that I've used a number of times. And it is to combine a bunch of different sources around a common tag. And so, actually, I'm using it in the context of this calendar project. So part of what's going on here is at one point I realized that as I started collecting all these iCalendar feeds, I realized that there is no equivalent to the RSS and Atom feed validator that was done by Sam Ruby and Mark Pilgrim, which had a huge effect, actually, in kind of helping RSS and then Atom to be usable by people, because, you know, all kinds of systems were producing feeds, as you know, and there was a lot of churn and a lot of confusion, and the validator made it, I attribute, you know, the level of interoperability that we have now in that space a lot to the validator. And there is no such validator for calendars, and there's, in the same way, there's lots of ways that you can informally kind of whip up a calendar feed, and it turns out that some of them aren't valid. So anyway, some people are interested in doing something along the lines of the validator. And actually, so there's a guy in the .NET world, Doug Day, who is the author of the .NET iCalendar component, which I'm now using in this service that I'm putting together. And then there's another guy, Ben Fortuna, who does a Java iCalendar toolkit called iCal4j. And those guys have been talking to each other and to some other people in the iCalendar community about this validator idea. And so to kind of draw things together, what I did is I put together this pipes-based meta feed of anything that's tagged in. So we were using the tag iCalValid to sort of collect stuff, right? And you know, you can have an iCalValid tag showing up in WordPress, or it could show up in Delicious, or it could show up as a Twitter hashtag, or I don't know, there's four or five other places where it could show up, right? And what the Yahoo Pipe thing does is it goes to all of those sources and says, give me anything that's tagged iCalValid across that set of things as a single feed. And I mean, I love that pattern, right? Because it frees people from having to commit to using any particular system, and you can have an awareness of the activity that clusters around that tag across a range of things. So that's my favorite Pipes real world application. What have you guys used it for?
Well, I've used it for getting information that's not Silverlight and Flash have this cross-domain.xml thing where they're restricted from making cross-domain calls. And so I've used Yahoo Pipes to kind of be a middleman because Yahoo has set up Yahoo Pipes so that it is cross-domain accessible. So from Silverlight, I'll call into Yahoo Pipes, which then calls over to Wikipedia or wherever and gets, you know, cross-domain.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But
is that working well for you?
Well, you know, actually, I did it just because I ran into an issue and couldn't stop. Like I had to find out the workaround, but I just did it, figured out how to do it, and then moved on. So, but I mean, it did work. It did pull the information over. So.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I was just kind of like, one of the first things people run into when they're, you know, really building out a Silverlight app is that you've got to make cross-domain calls to places that don't allow them. And so then what do you do? And Yahoo Pipe seems mm-hmm. like one of the better. You either do a you know, proxy on your own server, or you use Yahoo to do the same thing. So I don't know.
That's interesting.
Any other guys using Yahoo Pipes for anything?
I did a couple of little things where one of them was I wanted to kind of keep track of comment feeds where I had posted a comment and kind of monitor blog comment feeds basically. And I wanted to aggregate those all into one big feed. So I did a little, Pipes mashup where I had it was a remember the milk to-do list, which exposes an RSS feed. And that each entry in the to-do list was a comment feed that I was interested in monitoring. And then Pipes would mush those all together into one big feed. So that I didn't have to, have a million different feeds that I was tracking. So yeah, that was
kind of fun. Feed splicing is a really important pattern, and it's almost the paradigmatic use of Pipes, I think, is feed splicing.
But the notion of being able to mash, mix these things up and slice them and dice them and recombine them without sitting down and hashing out code seems like really powerful, but it hasn't really made the leap from programmery to, something an end user could do. And I'm curious if you think that that's something that at some point we'll grow towards.
Well, I've seen a few non-programmers embrace it, actually. I know a group of people who are doing curation of online resources. So it's a bunch of folks in the radio world, actually, and now they're doing online aggregation and producing stuff that draws on resources that are available online, and they're doing this kind of thing in a very clever way, but they're not developers, right? But it's actually interesting because when I saw what they had done, which was it was the equivalent. It's like if they came to you or to me and they said, we have this problem that we want to solve, our first instinct would be to say, yeah, so you need a database-backed web application, and we know how to build those. So we'll be happy to do that for you, and it'll have forms, and it'll have this, and it'll have that, right? And they didn't have the money to get one of those done. So they wound up cobbling something together based on, in fact, Pipes and based on Delicious. And they have what amounts to an application that lets them collaboratively sort of troll through a bunch of different sources of audio content that they've identified and build collections and turn those collections into playlists and even produce a web page that'll play those playlists. And they're doing it all with just effectively the end user capabilities of Pipes and Delicious. It's really instructive.
When you're presenting the problem, I've found that it's like I always try and think like a non-programmer, if possible, when I'm getting asked a question, because so many times the answer is not write a custom application. It's, go over here and sign up for an account, or, we'll make a simple HTML page and hard code it, and you'll update it once a year. I mean, there's times for an elegant solution, and then there's times for a non-programmer solution.
Well, and there's also the pattern where the non-programmer solution shows the developer what really wants to be codified into an application. And, my best example of that is, do you know the service called LibriVox? So LibriVox is free audiobooks, LibriVox.com.
My kids just finished listening through Treasure Island on there, and they loved it. So, yep.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's interesting how LibriVox happened. It was another one of these cases where the people that got together weren't in a position to hire programmers. And so they actually built the thing out on PHPBB. And PHPBB is still the backbone. It's like the workflow backbone of LibriVox production. So, they just worked out some conventions around you know, naming conventions for this is the queue of stuff that's being edited. This is the queue of stuff that needs to be sound checked. This is the queue of stuff that's done. And just by kind of naming threads and naming messages inside of threads and moving things from one place to another, they've evolved this workflow. But then, you know, as time has gone on, what you see is that there are sort of more formal bits of information systems and software engineering that are being woven into the fabric of this. And so at some point, somebody actually did build a database for at least the core of the catalog information. And it's fascinating for me to see how this is being woven in, so that now in the LibriVox, still in the PHP bulletin board system, there are places where in the message that that says that, you know, this thing is at this stage of the workflow, somebody actually puts in some iframe stuff in a, you know, some sort of template that goes actually into the body of the message that pulls a view from the database of a set of things, right? So it's a real interesting progression. And, you know, I think that the, at least this is what I think, I'm not sure exactly that Hugh McGuire, who was kind of the leader of this thing, completely agrees with me, but my contention was that this was a model demonstration of how you can have users operating in an environment where the environment itself is malleable enough for them to be able to both express their intentions and get actual work done in such a way that the intentions that they express can then be observed and improved upon by some additional programming effort. I mean, I think that's a beautiful model.
So one kind of common thread I'm hearing through the calendaring aspects, the pipes, this LibriVox site, is kind of this age-old problem of how do we let non-programmers program? And this is kind of, you know, it's been solved in many ways by different things. There was HyperCard on the old Apple systems, the idea being that, you know, you could drag things around and very simply put together programs. You had VBA macros, the Access form designers, and, you know, every now and then, you know, something will pop up that shows some promise, but we're still back to the point where you can only do really simple things, you know, if you don't know how to program. And I'm wondering if this is a problem that's solvable, or if the best we can do is, you know, stuff like pipes and Microsoft PopFly, or just, I don't know, maybe the best we can do is just build services and hope that they can kind of mash it together on their own. You know, I've seen people, you know, family members use sites and programs in ways that I never would have thought of as a software designer, because it would be so much simpler to write a workflow or something for it, you know, or to put that into code versus, you know, where they'll output something in one program and then copy and paste that into an email and send it off, and then someone else copies and pastes that content onto their, you know, website.
Well, you left Excel off of the list, of course.
No, I talked about VBA, and that's kind of what I was thinking of when I talked about VBA, was the Excel macros.
Yeah, but see, I think even the more fundamental aspect of Excel as a kind of surface on which people for the longest time have been able to express intentions is just the sheet itself, right? Just the cells in the spreadsheet, and the ability for people to, because it is such a neutral and such a plastic medium, that there are all kinds of things that people have been able to express. Just
there are only two basic computer interfaces. There's Word and there's Excel. And everything else kind of feeds off of one of those two interfaces. So they either want it just as free flow text that they can just type into, or they want little cells that they can put things into and relate somehow. Yeah, so they being users in this case.
Yeah. But I mean, an enormous amount of end user innovation and creativity has been expressed in the context of the Excel spreadsheet. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Doug Purdy today for a podcast that I have done with him about Oslo. And, you know, he said it before, he'll say it again, you know, that Excel is the model, right? You know, that they only hope that they can produce something that can have the kind of broad appeal and, you know, profound interactive simplicity that, you know, just the basic functions of Excel presented to a great many people. So it was, you know, not just the spreadsheet, not just Excel, but the spreadsheet as a metaphor for doing things. I'm curious what you guys think about Oslo, actually.
Silence.
Kevin's the only one of us that really knows much about it.
That's not true. K-Scott does too, I suspect.
K-Scott has looked at it, but I guess I've mostly looked at it with the intention that I'll be using it to build a DSL one day. I was really kind of put off by the original Oslo content that I saw at the PDC, which was just showing another way to use text to create database tables. That's kind of how it came across to me at first. And I realized that there's a lot more to it than that, but I haven't dug into it enough yet, but it's the M grammar type stuff that I'm really interested in.
I'm kind of in the same vein. I kind of feel like I've only seen like little glimpses of the Oslo full vision, and so that's kind of made it hard for me to kind of evaluate in totality. The little pieces I've seen, I'm a little skeptical on, but again, I feel like I'm not getting like the whole picture yet. Right. So I'm reserving judgment until I see that. But I agree, yeah. The textual DSL stuff is, as an external DSL stuff, is fairly cool.
So have you found yourselves in situations where you've been needing to or wanting to or actually have built some kind of little language for some domain?
I found myself in that situation last year. It was not to go into the domain too much, but I was provided with several hundred pages of flowcharts that were written by an agency that gives you the logic to determine if a hospital is keeping good care of its patients or not. And the logic just goes on and on and on. I was just looking for a way to express those. And I tried out a couple different things. I tried out the rules engine in Windows Workflow, and that didn't work out very well. And just for kicks, I tried, you know, using C# and if else statements just to see what would happen, and that was a disaster. So I was really looking for a way to take those flowcharts and just have them codified in a way that was going to be easy to maintain and easy to change, and something where someone could look at the text on the screen, you know, something that was going to be compiled into running bits, look at that text and then look at the flowchart and be able to sync the two in their mind real easily. And what came out of that was a little language.
So how did you parse that little language?
Well, it ended up being just I guess what some people call an internal DSL. Some people call it a Fluent API, just a series of extension methods in C# that we could chain together. So we could say define a shape, define the rules for that shape, define the destination for those rules if they evaluate to true. And it's C# code, but it reads a bit like English.
That sounds like a really good use of extension methods.
Yep, and it works out really well because that's really easy to unit test, and it compiles, and it's easy to refactor. And the end result, too, is that it's really easy to look at the C# code and look at the shape it's creating and relate that to the exact place in the PDF file for the flowchart that someone else is defining for us.
Nice. Sounds like a good solution.
See, mine was a lot simpler. I was we had some downtime, and I was helping out the SDETs on our team with some Selenium testing. And one of the things that we were trying to test was a very heavy JavaScript interface. Basically, the entire application was just a JavaScript client script with callbacks to air quote web services, which were, you know, ASPXs that wrote out JavaScript objects that we'd read in. Very old school. But one of the things that I was noticing about the tests that they were writing was that they included lots of calls to Selenium, and there was lots of repeated code. So I thought, well, I'll put together a little class that'll expose a Fluent interface, which ended up being a DSL. And there's a difference between a Fluent interface and a DSL, in my opinion. Yeah, Fluent interfaces often read as legible code. they're understandable by humans, a little bit easier to understand. Whereas DSLs are readable. You can infer the flow or the workflow, in my opinion at least, by reading a DSL versus a fluent interface, which may just be understandable. But anyway, off topic. So one of the things I did was I encapsulated some common tasks that took a lot of Selenium calls into this fluent interface. So you would have, you know, a call for create new thing. And then the call wasn't create new thing, but just, I don't want to expose too much of our underlying code. And then, you know, load web page. So as you started to write your Selenium tests, you were just using this DSL. So it'd be, you know, create new thing, associate thing with that, add in a repeat method. So you could repeat the last call X number of times. And then finally had an end method, which just cleaned up everything after itself. And at that point, you could then start to write your asserts or do whatever you needed to do. And I was really happy with the way that the test came out. But I'm not sure, relating this back to Oslo and the kind of, you know, this metaprogramming idea. I think JetBrains has a new metaprogramming language or something that they're putting out. I'm not sure that there's a way that isn't extremely verbose, or I guess I'm worried that, you know, XML at one point was promised as the way to write DSLs. Mm-hmm. And I see Oslo as, you know, you either make it so open-ended that you can never accurately describe it with any kind of a schema or anything that could possibly constrain it, or it ends up being so rigid that it doesn't cover enough cases to make it really useful except in simple cases. And that's kind of where my skepticism comes in about Oslo.
Yeah, I think that's, well, I hear a lot of that. And, you know, for what it's worth, I don't really know any more about it than you guys do. I, you know, saw the same stuff at the PDC. I've listened to those sessions since then as a kind of a refresher, and I've read through the docs, you know, but I haven't, you know, I haven't actually done anything with Oslo other than, you know, read about it and talk about it. So I'm in the same boat as you guys as far as that's concerned. But there's a few things that I find very appealing about it. And one of them kind of clicked into place today, actually, as I was having this conversation with Doug Purdy about it. And that is that, actually, it's a point that Don Box made in the PDC talk that he gave about Oslo, which is that you can start out very unconstrained, and you can actually get something that is workable, right? You can begin to put some data out there, you can begin to state some relationships, and you can begin to do some things. And then, as you learn more about what you're working with, you can progressively ratchet down the constraints and add more discipline to it. And it all of a sudden struck me that for the longest time, I feel like I've been searching for some kind of a happy middle ground between the world of statically typed and the world of dynamically typed development, because, you know, it's like one of those religious wars where I'm coming right down the middle. You know, I see benefit on both sides of the thing, and I'm always looking to sort of get the best of both worlds. And so, and I'm kind of feeling that now in this project that I'm working on. You know, I thought originally that I was going to be able to deploy Iron Python in Azure, and as yet that's not really very feasible. So, you know, I've wound up kind of building the core of this thing in C#. It's actually more C# than I've ever done. And I've enjoyed that a lot, and I've really been appreciating what that environment has to offer. And at the same time, you know, I'm trying to craft these interfaces in such a way that they're also very accessible to Iron Python, so that you know, a lot of the auxiliary reporting and administrative functions can feed off of the same core interfaces and the same core objects. Because, you know, I also have an incredible appreciation for what you can do in a dynamic language. And the observation, though, is that it still feels like those are two worlds that even as well as they can interoperate on the .NET platform, they're still two different worlds. And so, you know, I just it just felt to me like this could be an interesting way for us to be able to operate in a world where It's all the same stuff. And, you know, you can kind of turn the dial in a very continuous way from, you know, strongly typed to loosely typed to untyped. I think that's interesting. I don't, you know, I can't make any grand claims for what it'll actually mean, but I think it just feels interesting to me.
So, transitioning, you've been, you know, mentioning dynamic languages, and I certainly have a love of them. My language of choice is the J word that I may not be allowed to speak because the other guys will roll their eyes. But I'm a big JavaScript fan. But
why should anyone apologize for that?
I don't. It's a kind of a running joke. It's like a drinking game. Anytime Scott, you know, makes a comparison to JavaScript, everyone takes a shot of whatever they want.
We tried it as a drinking game, but our calls quickly deteriorated. So,
and I've noticed that you've been working with a lot with Azure and SQL Data Services with Iron Python, and I thought that was amazing because, you know, back in the day, I remember you doing lots and lots of Python work, and I was somewhat amused to see that you transitioned to Iron Python, and I wondered if part of that was because it's just so much more accessible at where you're working now, or if it was, you know, just because it's still Python. It's you know, still Python.
Well, the particular reason why I'm doing it in the context of this project is that there's sort of multiple objectives that I have, and one of the objectives actually is to surface the restful aspect of Azure in a very clear way. One of the things that I noticed personally when I approached the SDK for Azure is that it was pitched, I think, very much at a .NET developer audience. And, in this case, I think at the expense of clarity around what the sort of core RESTful interface to these services is, which, you know, I think at the PDC keynote, there was, you know, some wonderful demonstrations of that. I mean, I thought that I was just elated when I saw the Don Box and Chris Anderson keynote, in which, you know, very strongly what was presented was this notion of interface uniformity, right? And there was, I think, actually an example where, you know, literally the same code walked through a structure that came from SQL Data Services and a structure that came from Live Services. I'm not sure if that's quite the right example, but, you know, I thought that was just, you know, wonderful to see. But, you know, in working with the Azure SDK, it's, you know, and I'm thinking in particular of the storage stuff. It's all very cleverly done to provide things like link access to the services, right? And make it, you know, look the way you would expect if you were expecting a link provider. But part of what I hope I am doing at Microsoft is making connections between the Microsoft developer world and the, you know, other world that's out there where people are coming from a very different mindset. You know, people just want to write, you know, Ruby on Rails, and they want to write Python, and they want to write JavaScript, and they want to write a bunch of stuff, you know, that taps into services, right? And whatever you think about link, it's not going to be available in those contexts. So those people are going to be hitting the, you know, the sort of core REST APIs. And so anyway, part of what I wanted to do was, you know, package up these interfaces in a way that you could just use from any language like regular Python. And actually, that's the first thing that I did. And then just as a matter of convenience, I realized that I needed to do, because I'm deploying the core of this stuff in C#, I needed this core to be done in C#. And so rather than completely re-implement the core in pure Python, although it's perfectly feasible, you know, I just basically did the core in Iron Python, and I'm hoping that, or excuse me, I did the core in C#, and then there's C# and Iron Python consumers of the core. But, you know, does that make sense? But I mean, I actually, you know, there are some examples of pure Python accessing the Azure services, and it's you know, perfectly possible to do a good job of that, and you know, you could have the equivalent in Ruby, and you could have the equivalent in a lot of other languages. You know, one of the frustrations that I've always had actually about the open source dynamic language communities, much as I love them, is that they are so fragmented around you know, kind of core interface libraries. You know, it always kind of bugged me that you know, when Python came along, it had to re-implement in Python all of the same libraries that you had in Perl, right? Because it was Python, not Perl, you know, so you had to have your LDAP library and you had to have your this, that, and the other library. And then, you know, Ruby came along in the same thing, right? So you wind up with, you know, this explosion, this matrix of combinations of this runtime, this language, and this, you know, this core library. And so I was, you know, one of the things that really attracted me to .NET early on was the notion that this common runtime says that you can have, you know, language innovation around a common core of stuff that doesn't need to get re-implemented once per language. I think that that's I continue to be really interested in that. I don't feel like I've interested many other people in that proposition, but I think it's important and interesting.
Well, one of the things that surprised me when one of the announcements at the PDC about the .NET live services, not the framework, but the services part, was that they announced and released frameworks for Python and Ruby, and I thought that was interesting because one of the big pain points for using Passport was the fact that it was so hard to get a foothold in, and so yeah. The only people that ever used Passport were, you know, Microsoft sites, and even they paid a heavy price in some cases to get on board. And I was kind of elated to see that they were releasing these libraries for non, you know, Microsoft, you know, languages, even though, you know, we've got Iron Ruby and Iron Python coming out, and we'll probably have Iron Lisp and Iron Logo before the end of 2010. And I wondered if that was maybe a starting point to enabling the ability to sign in with your live ID to Rails sites or, you know, to Django sites maybe. And I know that you've also done some work around identity, and I'm wondering if you had any thoughts kind of on how, you know, this idea of a core library or core implementation around this REST service kind of ties in with identity, or if I'm just talking.
Well, no. I mean, it's a huge topic, and it is related. And so, you know, there's a set of identity oriented services that are coming on top of Azure, and you know, I don't actually know an awful lot about that stuff yet. But, you know, my hope and my expectation is that stuff will be done in a way that's consistent with the design philosophy of the Azure services, you know, that people are starting to be able to tire kick and work with now. And that would imply that, you know, they expose RESTful interfaces, you know, and in some cases, you know, formal web services interfaces as well, because, you know, some of that stuff involves crypto and, you know, a few extra layers, but that it'll all be standards based and that it'll all be accessible, you know, from any platform, because this is a new ball game, right? This is, you know, this is the cloud, and the cloud is a new playing field, and it's just good business to want as many people to come and play on your field as can.
So talking about, you know, digital identity, I think that obviously that is a huge other topic, but I'm just interested in what you see as kind of the progress of things like OpenID. I know that there's card space, which I think I've been frustrated by kind of the lack of movement from Microsoft as far as actually doing something or supporting it. You know, it's a technology that I haven't seen put into use. But OpenID, I've really seen some kind of movement with lately over the past year, where sites are actually starting to act, you know, to not just support OpenID as a identity provider, but accept ID as a login. Mm-hmm. What do you think about kind of the progress of OpenID? Does it seem like it's picking up, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely picking up to some degree. I've actually used it a few times this week. Let me think. When did I actually use it this week? Maybe only with spokenword.org. But, you know, yeah, it's something that there are a few places where I go and it's like, oh, thank you for me, you know, not having to use a separate credential for this thing. The domain in which OpenID is operating right now, it feels pretty geeky to me. I mean, I don't think that there are any people in the category of what I call civilians who are, I think that there are very few of them who have or have used OpenID. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I think that's true. It seems like it's making, you know, slow steps into the mainstream, but it's still really around the, you know, the blogging / programming world.
So, you know, that's always the interesting question. Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's the interesting question is how does this stuff cross the chasm? And, you know, I'm with you. I had, you know, have had high hopes, continue to actually have high hopes for Cardspace, the information card model. I'm a huge fan of Kim Cameron. And, you know, I expect that will land at some point. But I feel like I've been waiting a really long time for us to get to the point where this stuff actually breaks out, and it's not just something that geeks and programmers and bloggers know about. So I sort of share that frustration. You know, it's interesting though. You guys know who Phil Windley is?
But
I don't know what Phil's title is at IT Conversations. He's, I think, the executive editor. You know, Phil was the CIO of the state of Utah. He's a BYU computer science professor. He's an author. He's an incredibly multi-talented guy. And among his many other activities, he's starting a company right now. The company is called Kynetx, K-Y-N-E-T-X. And Kynetx's mission is to do what they call, I think, contextual browsing, or to contextualize web experiences. And you know, Phil, actually, his book is the O'Reilly Digital Identity book. So he's been, you know, thinking about this stuff for a long time, and, you know, very engaged with the group of folks who, you know, kind of got together and hammered out the consensus that, you know, was formalized in the laws of identity that Kim Cameron talks about. Anyway, so Phil, I just read a white paper that he published last week about the architecture of what they're doing, and he, in fact, will be using information cards as a way of doing what information cards do. And so, you know, I'm rooting for him, and you know, I can't wait to see what happens.
Wow! Yeah, that could be one of the first big uses of this. That's cool. Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, this is something where I've, you know, I heard your, I heard that when you guys interviewed Kim Cameron on the Gilmore Gang in 2004, and, you know, I kind of caught the bug for this digital identity as a, it's good for everyone. In terms of a user going to a website, I want the site to know who I am. Like, I don't want to have to log in. I don't want to be anonymous everywhere I go. I want contextualized experiences. And then from the point of view of a, you know, somebody running a site, it's good to just ambiently know who my users are, to just, you know, like, context is good for a provider as well, to be able to give, you know, like, in terms of anything, providing content, I want to give content that users actually want. So I think it's good everywhere. It's just this frustrating, like, long gap in waiting for the plumbing to get hooked up. It feels like we're kind of waiting for the IT department to come and hook up our computers, you know? So.
Yep. I know what you mean.
You had mentioned recently webhooks as kind of an aside in a post about remote working. And I just thought that that was kind of a, I'm starting to see some mention of that on the web. I think that this kind of goes back to this idea of wiring the web and, you know, kind of hooking things together in a very kind of organic, you know, just loose connection points.
Absolutely.
So how would you describe like the promise of webhooks?
Well, I think it's going to be one of those things that, you know, how Ajax came along and basically suddenly the word kind of crystallized a pattern that people had already been doing for a long time. But it was one of those moments where you got the word and then that crystallized the pattern. And then it suddenly, you know, we all became more aware of it, but it wasn't like, you know, we'd all been doing that anyway. It was, you know, we'd all been doing, you know, JavaScript and XML, HTTP object and things like that for quite a while. And, you know, DHTML obviously was very well established by then. And yet, you know, it was sort of this conceptual thing that came together at a moment in time. And it feels like webhooks is trying to be that as well. And I think it deserves to be, right? Because it's just another sort of perhaps moment where we sort of crystallize that, yeah, this stuff, it's, you know, we're actually already doing some of these things. And if we just become more aware of it, we can make more of our existing implementation of this idea and be more aggressive about making more and better use of it going forward. The thing that I've been feeling for quite a while now is that I want pretty much all of the points at which I interact with services to be able to produce events that I can then work with. Just for example, right? I mean, if I go and I put a bookmark onto Delicious, or even if I just assign a tag to something on Delicious, or if I rename a tag, right? Those are all sort of events in some stream of events that have to do with my interaction with that service. Well, why shouldn't I be able to, or anybody who I want to be able to, hook into those things? You know, I mean, right now you can hook into the feed, which is, you know, sort of the aggregation of all the stuff that I've done. But, you know, being able to hook into the stuff in a more granular way is just, you know, it's really straightforward to be able to provide that capability. And it's just one of those open-ended things that I think will lead to a lot of unpredictable, sometimes crazy, but I think mostly really useful results. You know, I can think of, and I'm sure you can think of examples where you've already done this kind of thing, right?
You know, I'm sure I have. This it doesn't feel like a new pattern at all.
Yeah, it's not. It's not.
I guess we should describe it too. You know, I just kind of jumped in with the term webhooks, but the idea is that you, when an event happens on a website, that we say, hey, when this happens, ping this URL. So I guess in a way it's almost like a trackback.
Yeah.
But better, because we can say when, like for example, Google Code has post commit webhooks. So we say when somebody commits to this project, ping this URL. And then it's up to me. It could be pinging my server. It could be pinging a public server that says send an email or update a wiki or do whatever.
Yeah. Probably weblogs.com was the sort of archetypal example of that, and one that I think a number of people became at least indirectly familiar with, because, you know, I mean, it's not so evident to people now, but there was a time when if you were setting up a blog, you know, you could become aware of, well, there was this way of notifying other services when you posted, and you could configure, and there could be like different places where you sent those messages. I forget the details, right? But, you know, people, you know, became aware of the model, I think, even back then, like 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, so is what we're talking about here, is this kind of like the Facebook Connect stuff that's happening, where you can allow things to publish back and forth? Like other websites can now publish information to Facebook and pull things out of Facebook. Is that kind of what we're talking about? Or is this something different?
I see it more as a network of events. You know, so that, again, you know, that you know, my interaction with some service can, well, it always does at least implicitly produce a sequence of events, you know, and those events could just go nowhere, or they could get logged by the service but they could also be made available, right, to other parties who would want to register an interest in listening for those events and might want to do something about it, right? I mean, it's sort of the pub-sub mechanism and topology ultimately, right? You know, and, you know, so you have event publishers and event subscribers, and in a system where the publishing and subscribing functions are very generalized, you just have an extraordinary amount of flexibility to combine things in useful ways.
Anyone else have anything else they'd like to throw in about that before we wrap up?
I didn't have anything to comment on that, but before we quit, I just wanted to thank John for helping me find spokenword.org. I've been a big fan of audio content for probably 10 years now, trying to get audio content off the internet so that I can use it in those idle times to consume information. And this is a great site.
What are you finding in your use of it at this point? I'm curious.
Well, I just discovered it from your blog just, half an hour ago.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it looks like the types of things that I have a hard time finding. So things like documentaries, which, you know, might have been published a couple years ago, they don't bubble up in RSS readers and things like that. But it looks like I can find stuff like that on this site.
Yeah, it's I'm pretty encouraged by the way things are going. And it's actually another one of these examples of trying to, I think, bring ultimately to a much wider audience this sort of notion of working in terms of data feeds and thinking about actually combining feeds. In fact, one of the important use cases for this, which emerged, and it wasn't part of Doug Kay's original plan at all, but it's turned out to be something that, you know, I found that I was really wanting to use it for, and it seems that a lot of other people were as well, is that it's a way of consolidating the stuff that you wind up downloading in your podcatcher. Mm-hmm. Right? So I can take, you know, multiple things and flow them into, just like we were talking before about taking pipes and using it to, you know, take a fan in from a bunch of things, you know, down to a consolidated feed. It'll actually do that for me. I don't know what you guys use, but I'm actually using iTunes as a podcatcher. And now with spoken word, I mean, I could have done it, you know, in a geekier way, but this is actually, I think the point is that, you know, this is a way that a civilian might be able to sort of manage that feed fan in a way where, you know, they wouldn't be able to go to pipes or something like that to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty handy, you know, and then the discovery aspect of it is, you know, we're just going to be finding out how that goes, but I'm starting to feel really good about it. You know, just in the last few days, actually, I just kind of scan, you know, once or twice a day, I kind of scan the activity, and I have picked up a number of new things. And for me, it really is about picking up the feeds, not just the individual programs, right? So they're, you know, my whole thing is, you know, if I can find a feed that I can scan, and, you know, there's even just a few things over time that are really valuable to me in that feed, then that's a big win, right?
And I'm
definitely finding those kinds of things. So it's actually pretty exciting. Are you guys listed there? You should be.
We are. I went out to sign us up and someone else already had, but then I went in and added all my other favorite podcasts. So,
you know what? That's interesting. I have yet to submit a feed that wasn't already there. Which partly may say that the universe of feed URLs is actually still pretty small.
So how would you describe the kind of like the, what's the elevator speech for spoken word that it gives you over a, you know, your podcatcher idea? It's the discovery and aggregation kind of idea?
Yeah. Collaborative curation, I would say, is the elevator pitch. And actually the, you know, my first experience of that was 4 or 5 years ago with a site called WebJ. I don't know if you guys remember that. It was a fellow I know, Lucas Gantz, who did that site. And I just fell right in love with it. And then a couple of years later, he got bought by Yahoo, and then Yahoo shut it down. Lucas is still with Yahoo. He's working on the Yahoo media player and some other stuff. But WebJ was kind of a magical thing. So what it was is, it was a playlist sharing environment, right? So you would basically form playlists, which were sets of links to MP3s. And the idea was that you would just point to stuff that was legitimately free and legal music that was being shared openly on the web and was intended to be referenced. And then the real magic was that there were a couple of people who emerged in that environment who were very reliable guides to all kinds of crazy, wacky music that I never would have discovered on my own. And I wound up for probably like 6 months, actually, tuned in to three or four of these folks, one in particular. Her name is Audio Katya. That's what she calls herself. She's still around on the web. It's Audio, O-D-D-I-O, Katya, K-A-T-Y-A. And she's just a collector and a curator of all kinds of interesting free and legal music. But anyway, when she was really active on WebJ, it was an amazing thing. Because first of all, I was tuned into her. And I was just getting like a steady feed of stuff that I just really liked to listen to. But then the idea was that these playlists would be sort of like DNA, right, that then people could mix and match. And so what could happen is you would clone somebody else's playlist, you would drop some stuff out, you would add some stuff in of your own, right? So people were kind of mixing these things around, and you could see, you know, how a popular, it was like you could watch like a meme, you know, kind of migrate from one person's collection to another. So anyway, I thought of that when Doug said that he wanted to do spoken word as a way of discovering and sharing and collecting stuff. And I actually put him in touch with Lucas, and so they talked a lot about that. And so I think WebJ is a predecessor to spoken word, and a lot of the same dynamics are there. It's just, you know, it's going to be interesting because the spoken word domain is just a different thing from music. And so there's a whole set of dynamics there that make it different in ways I don't think I even understand yet, but I'm really interested to see how it plays out.
I just saw on there a format I hadn't seen before, XSPF, which is XML shareable playlist format. Is that right?
I should know more about that, and I'd have to look it up, frankly. I mean, it's a thing that Lucas was and is really, really big on. You know, what I will say is that in general, Lucas has had a huge interest in figuring out how to. He was always offended, as I was offended, by the kind of siloization of media players. And, you know, he wanted media and media playing to flow in a very natural way on the web. And so actually the media player that pops out on the spoken word page, that's Lucas's project. That's the Yahoo media player. Right. So it's this dynamic HTML kind of thing that you can embed in web pages, and you know, you can actually, there's a bookmarklet that you can use. So if you hit a web page that's got a bunch of MP3 links on it, you can just sort of hit the bookmarklet and materialize this flyout Ajax player, right, in the context of that page. That's the kind of stuff he's been up to.
Ah, yep, we used that for a while. All right, well, that's all the time we have this week. So thanks a lot, John, for staying up late and showing up with us.
Well, thanks, guys. My pleasure.
All right, catch us next week on Herd and Code. Yeah,
thanks for coming on. This was
interesting. Great.
I said earlier, my brain hurts now. I need to go talk to someone dumb. For a little bit, come down off the high.
Well, you know, just stay on the line after John leaves and us.
You know, I think what we normally do is we kind of focus on the nitty-gritty technologies, and you know, and a lot of time our guests are experts on one specific technology. And I think like a lot of what you're doing, John, and what we've been talking about is kind of connecting the dots and tying things together, and. A lot of the time, it's not like it's not incredible rocket science, but it's just kind of it's the work to actually hook things together. But it's actually, and then it's the kind of reward. I mean, that's the actual payoff. Then is to make something useful as opposed to just talk about the technologies all the time.
Yeah, it is honestly a big and I would say even a growing frustration for me. That and I I say this is true equally in the Microsoft domain and in the, you know, kind of free and open source Tim O'Reilly world as well. You know, that because I've hung around in both of those worlds, and in both of those worlds, I increasingly have been feeling that, you know, people are like very focused on the tech and the details of the tech, you know, and you know, I'm trying to get this stuff to connect to like the world, you know, because we need it, right? I mean, we're in like deep shit basically as a society and a civilization, right? And you know, the stuff that's going to dig us out of the hole is really going to have a lot to do with what we do. But you know, we are like spectacularly bad at connecting what we do to those real issues. You know what I mean? We just, and me too. I mean, you know, I've tried and so far almost completely failed, you know, to be able to have conversations with people about this stuff that don't make their eyes glaze. Right.
And yeah, I think that's very true.
You know, it's just, I haven't figured that one out yet. But if you guys,
I think that's the nature of the beast with programmers and technologists on a mailing list where we're talking about, you know, what's next in C#. And, you know, I kind of mentioned a big picture thing, you know, where, you know, why do I have to think about concurrency? I'd like the compiler just to take care of that. And everyone was much more interested in finding out the exact role that nullability should play. You know, down to the exact syntax and hammering it out, and it's a lot easier than dealing with the overarching kind of goals. You know, how is this technology going to be used is not as interesting to programmers as how am I going to implement it. In some cases,
that's very true, and I wonder why.
I think it's control. I think that it's the same reason that when presented with a user requirement that a programmer doesn't understand, the first thing they decide to write is a framework, because they can control the framework.
Yeah.
They can't actually solve the problem, but they can write a framework that'll solve it, right? It's all we need is an API.
Yeah, or anyway, have fun writing it.
Right.
Exactly.
I think that just so many of these things take time and trial and error and you know, like for instance, I was saying earlier, I really got excited about hearing that way long ago when you talked to Kim Cameron, and I've kind of followed that. And then, you know, recently I don't know if you follow Jeff Atwood and Stack Overflow, but it's like a programming help site. And
Stack Overflow is kicking ass. It's really starting to turn up as a source of useful answers.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. And so my one real contribution to it early on was, you know, Jeff was talking about, you know, how should he do login? And I was like, do OpenID. And, you know, here's why, and here's the benefits, and, you know, here's what this will do. And they'd already actually written a login system, and you know, like I caught him on the right day or whatever, but he ended up scrapping that and moved over to OpenID. And I think that that's been helpful in terms of, you know, now people that use Stack Overflow are able to jump over to User Voice and make comments, and then they're able to, you know, they're starting up this IT focused Stack Overflow site, and so then they'll be able to use it there. And I think that, you know, that it's kind of like actually seeing it in action, you know. But it's like I think just so many of these things just take time, you know. It's like you have to try and use things different places, and you know, please use this here. No, okay, well, please use it here, and you know, try and sneak it in different places, and you know, wait for something to catch.
That's part of it, but then part of it is there's you know, very rarely something comes along and it clicks with a wider group of people. And, you know, and those moments are sort of inflection points, you know, where things can change in a big way. and not just within the technical community, but where, you know, what we do really, you know, I mean, I think part of why we're all in this is because it has changed the world and it can change the world. But a lot of the times it doesn't feel like it is changing the world, but we know that it has and we know that it will again, right? So we're all sort of in it for those, for those moments when that happens. And, you know, that's kind of lightning in a bottle, right? I mean, you can't, you know, necessarily engineer it or predict it, right? But you can, you know, you can hope to be in the right place at the right time and be doing the right things when you're there.
Yep.
And if nothing else, you get some pretty stock certificates that you're going to use to burn for warmth later on when you're laid off. But that's the cynical view.
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. I enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Okay. All right.
Take care.
Okay. Good night.